Hey, yo, what is a cipher?
The idea was essentially to smuggle a movie about race and identity into cinemas, into the mainstream conversation, using the free money of the fact that this guy would go on to be the leader of the free world.
The knowledge of the cipher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cipher come from?
The gods.
Because you try to jump the cipher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cipher, a weekly podcast bringing you talks with the most interesting figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sataro. This is episode 182, a talk with our favorite author, Adam Mansbach. Adam wrote the screenplay for the movie Barry, out now on Netflix. Barry is a movie about a young man named Barry who transfers to Columbia University in 1981. It follows him through his first few months in New York City, discovering the city and himself, finding love, making and losing friends, and dealing with an absent father and a mother who he loves but is a little embarrassed by. Oh, and Barry's last name? Obama. The movie stars newcomer Devin Terrell as Obama, Anya Taylor-Joy is his girlfriend Charlotte, Avi Nash is his friend Salim, Eller Coltrane is his roommate Will, Jason Mitchell as fellow student PJ, and Ashley Judd is his mother Anne, along with, as you'll hear, a few surprise cameos. The film has been getting rave reviews and tons of award nominations, including NAACP Image Award and Independent Spirit Award noms for Adam himself. Adam, as longtime listeners of the show will remember, is best known for his children's book for adults, Go the Fuck to Sleep. He has also written great novels, including Angry Black White Boy and End of the Jews. We spoke to him via Skype from his home in California. If you're curious about any of the songs we're playing during this episode, visit thecyphershow.com to find a complete list and the show notes. While you're there, sign up for our monthly newsletter to stay on top of what we're up to, on the air and in the wider world. And now, here's a man who's been on The Cipher one more time than Pharaoh Monch, Adam Mansbach. So I guess, you know, I wanted to congratulate you since you came up with the Whites Against Trump hashtag and it was so successful, you know, number one trending Twitter topic. It started a mass of white people not voting for Trump and Hillary won in a landslide.
Yeah. I'm really glad to be here on the Alternate Reality podcast with you guys. It's really great. Fuck. Can I just stay here for the next 4 to 8 years?
Yeah, he's already saying eight in some of his public statements now, so yeah, it was crazy when I saw that the thing you and Kamau did and kind of this jokey essay in Salon actually like took off during one of the debates.
Yeah, that was really interesting. And at the time it was very gratifying to see people take up this notion of Whites Against Trump, which was really, you know, stemmed from a conversation that, as you say, we had on Salon, the gist of which was like, look, you know, when any Muslim organization anywhere in the world does or says anything objectionable, it somehow is incumbent on every Muslim in America to denounce, distance, etc., themselves from that statement or that action. If a black person does something crazy, it's incumbent on black America to disavow. White people never have to do that shit.
Saying white people need to take responsibility for Donald Trump. Can you please explain why?
I consider it my job to handle Ben Carson, Raven Simone, random black people on the internet. It's your job to handle Donald Trump. White people, get your boy. That's all I'm saying.
When we say handle, Kamau, handle. How did you handle, as you use in your post, Rachel Dolezal, for example? And white people handle Donald Trump?
I wrote blogs about it. I tweeted about it. I talked about it on stage as a comedian. That's what I do. I'm still talking about it. I'm recognizing the problem and talking about the problem and claiming my race when I talk about the problem. I'm not talking about Rachel Dolezal as a human being. I'm talking about her as a fake black person. And I think white people need to talk about Donald Trump as the worst. He's like the pinnacle of white privilege and white supremacy meeting in one place.
So the idea at the time, and this was like more than a year ago, was it's not enough just to denounce Trump. You've got to do it as a white person. He's running a campaign based on white ethno-nationalist fear and resentment. So don't just denounce and distance yourself from him. Do it as a white person. Make clear that he doesn't represent you as a white person. Like, do something good with your whiteness for once, with your privilege, with these unaccrued benefits you have. And it was interesting. People really, you know, and we sort of managed to encapsulate that at least partially in this hashtag. And, you know, Kamau is big on Twitter. And he put it out there right before this debate. And people really ran with it. And then people of color were like, finally, you know, there was a lot of response like, thank God you motherfuckers are doing this, because we were about to, like, you know, really completely give up hope on y'all, you know?
Yeah.
It was interesting. It was interesting. It came to nothing, clearly, but it was interesting.
Where were you? Where were you election night?
I was at my house. I had people over, and you know, we were watching it happen. And my daughter Vivian, the Jazz Wolf, as she's more widely known, was with us. And you know, for like 16 months, I'd been railing and fulminating against Trump and saying what an awful person he was and how completely fucked we would be would he get elected, while never believing that he would. And you know, sure, kids pick up everything. So as she watched the faces of her friends and family fall in dismay and shock as it became clear that he was going to win, she got really scared, you know, as you might if for the last year and a half somebody's been constantly telling you that this dude is like the boogeyman, and that if he wins, the country's going to hell, and then you watch him win. And I was like, wow, this is quite the parenting lesson. You know, like, I probably shouldn't have talked all that shit.
Right.
And then I had to try to dial it back and be like, no, you know, it's going to be okay.
Right. Something, you, something, institutions, you know? Something.
Yeah. And it was funny because she was coming up with all this crazy dystopian shit, like, almost instantly. You know, she's like, Papa, what if Trump bans all the books and nobody's allowed to read anything anymore? And I was like, yo, you're on your Ray Bradbury shit already? Like, that took like 20 minutes. Like, damn, okay.
Wow.
Literally the next morning, I had to go to L.A. and pitch a TV show. Like, the morning after the election, I was in L.A.
Oh, Jesus. So no one, you, the people being pitched to, no one was in any kind of mood for it?
Yo, it was so bugged out. It was me and Danny Hawk were in there pitching Rage Is Back, my book, which we developed as a TV show, and which we did sell ultimately that week to one of these networks. Yo, the first day, it was a 3-day, you know, thing. And I was like, Danny,
even though I'm from New York, but what's that? A color, a race, or a state of mind? A class of people, a culture, is it a rhyme?
If so, then what the hell am I, you might be saying?
Danny Hawk is a writer, actor, director, and performance artist. He first gained widespread notice for his one-man shows, Jails, Hospitals, and Hip Hop, and Some People. He has also acted in TV shows and films such as Nurse Jackie, The Nick, Black Hawk Down, and as you'll hear, Barry. Rage Is Back is Adam's 2013 novel, for which Danny did the audiobook.
I was calling him the night before. I was like, dude, we can't do this trip. Those buildings are going to be on fire tomorrow when we get there. Like, the execs are going to be, like, pulling copper wire out of the walls. Like, nobody wants to hear our pitch. It was really interesting. It was, the first day was rough. Everybody was just like, yeah, sorry, we're so low energy. Just say things, you know, speak, like, distract us. We're like, hey, who wants to buy a TV show? It was interesting, though, as we pitched, you know, successively again and again, in kind of subtle ways, the pitch became more focused in its kind of anti-authoritarian slant. You know, I mean, the show is, you know, the show, like the book, is basically one in which graffiti writers are heroes and the cops are the bad guys. And that became like more pointed, and the idea of a war between expression and suppression became more pointed as time goes on. And I don't know, in some weird way, we may have sold it because of the election. I'm pretty sure we're the first show to sell post-election. So for whatever that's worth, you know?
Yeah. Can you say what network it's on?
USA.
Congratulations. Nice.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. So yeah, I was actually listening to an interview you and Danny did talking about that. It sounds like you guys were working on it for like a couple of years, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Danny and I have been working on this show for, yeah, at least a couple of years. And part of me kind of like had accept, you know, part of me just like accepted that it was never going to sell, that we're possibly never even going to pitch it, that it was just like, you know, if nothing else, it was a great way to spend time with Danny. You know what I mean? Like, So it's a little surreal that you know, I mean, to be clear, like selling a show to a network only marginally increases the chances of your show being on television. So there's like a long way still to go.
Right.
But, you know, at least we're in the door.
Well, yeah. And congratulations on that. That's awesome.
Thank you.
So now I assume from spending all this time around Dani, the Jazz Wolf will have her own one-woman show opening very soon.
The Jazz Wolf is the rap name of Adam's 8-year-old daughter, Vivian. Familiar to readers from the covers of Go the Fuck to Sleep and You Have to Fucking Eat. The Jazz Wolf's first single and video, a New England tribute called Mush Lobster, is out now.
I'd rather buy a Fenway Frank for Bucky freaking Dent. Mush. Jackie.
Absolutely, yeah. The Jazz Wolf, the Jazz Wolf's exposure to Dani. I mean, so the method in which we've been working on this show, you know, Dani is a lot freer to travel than I am because he doesn't have kids. So he will stay with me here in Berkeley for like weeks at a time and kick it with me and the Jazz Wolf. And they've gotten very close. They do accents for each other and all kinds of stuff. And, you know, Dani's a great dude. And I would have felt fine about not selling the show because it was an excuse to spend like uncountable hours with Dani. And, you know, that's been its own reward. And like Dani is more serious about food, cares more about food, I think, than I care about anything. You know, this dude, like, I mean, he's so serious. He's an incredible cook. And like, if you go to his house for dinner, he's like, so what kind of food do you want? And you're like, I don't know. What are my options? And he'll be like, well, Oaxacan, Szechuan, and like, he'll name like four cuisines. And then he'll be like, those are the ones I don't cook, you know? And you're like, so anything else? He's like, yeah. And you know, he like travels to eat. Like he just got back from Italy where he went because it's white truffle season. Like this is the level of seriousness that this guy has. So like it's just the restaurant game is crazy. Like I cook much better because of Dani. He'll come to your house and shame you. He'll like open up my spice cabinet and be like, "Yo, you think this is red pepper, but it's not." And you're like,
"What does that even mean?
What does that even mean?" You know.
Well, you know, it's actually a pretty good bridge because Dani is obviously in the movie Barry that you wrote.
Yes.
As a racist security guard.
Yes.
You got some ID? I'm a student here. ID. I don't have to show you anything. Are you giving me a problem? We got a problem here? Well, I don't see you IDing them. So what's so special about me? Huh?
I'm going to ask you one more time.
Hey.
And
hey.
It's cool. I know this guy.
Playing against type, which was very funny. A kind of little sort of winking cameo, which was awesome.
Totally. Yeah.
So I guess, you know, the first thing, since we are right now, as we're speaking, probably a block east of Morningside Heights.
Mm-hmm.
So what, I know you did a lot of research for this. What was in Barack Hussein Obama's sealed transcripts?
Oh man, there's so much. There's the CIA recruitment letters. There's documents proving that his father was a British spy. Man, you know, it's funny. One of the depressing things about researching the movie was how prominently in any like rudimentary Google search you might do on something like literally if you type in like Barack Obama Sr., like the first shit that comes up is all this bugged out conspiracy stuff about how he was, you know, a spy or he wasn't really Obama's father and some other guy who's also a spy was, you know, just like craziness, you know?
Yeah, I think I Googled like that the speech from 95 in Cambridge, the suggested videos were like, this guy's really his father type shit.
Yeah. Yeah. It's pretty crazy. And I think, you know, to tie it back into the election, as aware as we've been for the last 8 years of how infuriating the racists of this country found his election and how deeply unsettled and agitated they've been by it and what that's led to from the Tea Party to everything else, we've still continued to underestimate it, you know, up to this day. Like the level of just straight up racist anger on the part of these folks is almost, I think, impossible for us to comprehend. Because we are not fueled by anything that hateful, period, full stop. And that comes to the fore when you're researching Obama very quickly, and it's very depressing.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things that stood out to me about Barry was something that wasn't there, which is to say, like, in biopics, even in biopics I like the NWA movie or whatever, mm-hmm. there's a ton of super clunky expository dialogue.
Right.
And this has, you know, little to none. How did you manage to avoid that?
That was a very conscious choice on our part, to avoid epiphanies, to avoid undue foreshadowing. You know, we essentially set out from the beginning to make a movie that was very compact in its time frame and did not include any necessarily transformative event in his life. I mean, small transformative events, events of significance, but nothing that is like, you stick the pin in this and this is the thing that changed him. Like, basically, I remember telling Vikram, the director, Vikram Gandhi, that if anybody could throw a voiceover over the trailer that was like, you know, the 5 months that made him who he is, then we had failed, basically. The idea was essentially to smuggle a movie about race and identity into cinemas, into the mainstream conversation, using the free money of the fact that this guy would go on to be the leader of the free world, but at the same time, make a movie that would be equally compelling, or, you know, 90% as compelling, if it were just about some guy who, like, grew up to be an accountant. Because I agree, I fucking hate biopics. Like, I can't watch them because, yeah, there's so much fan service, there's so much sort of service to history and, like, highlighting these moments and expository dialogue or revelatory dialogue. You know, like, what are you going to call your new label? Dramatic pause. Dr. Dre turns to the camera and is like, Death Row, or like Aftermath, or whatever the fuck.
So what you going to call that bullshit? Aftermath.
And you're like, this sucks. This is unwatchable.
Right. Another thing, like you said about the no epiphanies thing, is like you see him, Barry, reading and thinking a lot, often by himself in solitude. And the movie sort of goes out of its way never to have that lead to an epiphany, never to say like, oh, I've figured it out. And in fact, only to sort of show in flashes what he's actually thinking about.
Yeah, yeah. We wanted really to make this a movie about a guy who was in process. And it's funny because in some ways it's difficult to dramatize the kind of withdrawal from social life that partly characterizes his time at Columbia. You know, by the time he gets there, he's already been at Occidental for 2 years. He's coming from Jakarta, where he's spent, you know, his summer. And he's already peaked in terms of his, like, partying, drinking. You know, the cocaine is, like, long finished with. You know, that was back in Hawaii as a high school student. And this is about a seriousness and a kind of sobering up and a withdrawal and a monkishness, as he characterizes it in the book, that he's struggling with. So, yeah, we're kind of watching a guy toggle between a desire for connection, a desire for recognition in terms of the fullness of his humanity, and a guy who kind of just wants to withdraw and be left alone to figure it out. So, yeah, we see him reading. And I mean, we discussed all these choices. We discussed what he might have been reading, whether to show the spines of these books. And this time in his life is opaque enough that I really was making up most of this. You know, there were a few facts to which I was beholden, a few facts to which I kind of glommed on because they were so incredible. But, you know, choices like things as simple as like, what is he reading? We're going to take on significance and be parsed by people. So we wanted to be really careful. He reads Invisible Man. And that's something he talks about in the book. He talks about carrying around this kind of dog-eared copy of Invisible Man throughout his first semester, which on one hand is a little bit on the nose, right? I wouldn't necessarily put that book in his hand if it was up to me. But the fact is he did, so it gives us license to do that. And of course, there are going to be people who roll their eyes and are like, it's too on the nose. But it's like, nah, but that shit actually happened. But, you know, I'm trying to remember, like, I remember discussing with Vikram, like, what books he might have been reading, you know, just for our own edification. Like, Vikram is very exacting and precise and really wanted to be able to understand and defend and explain every line of every page of the script, which really pushed me in a great way. So, you know, it's like if I wrote Barry sits in the library reading a book, he'd be like, what book? And I'd be like, I don't know. And he'd be like, well, we need to figure it out.
I don't know. Yeah, whatever. Yeah.
So, you know, I remember like talking about different things like, well, would he be reading Saul Alinsky? No, he wouldn't. It's too early for that. You know, like, we definitely batted different things around. All of these, even the books that that Ramik, played by Fab Five Freddy, the book vendor on 125th Street, even the books he hands him or the books Barry picks up, you know, were things we discussed.
Right. And that, by the way, that was a great cameo. Since you said it, I'll say I had Fab Five Freddy playing the book vendor.
Here you go, brother.
Thank you, my brother. And I envy you for that one.
What's that?
Because you're about to read that for the first time. After you finish, slide back by and let me know how you liked it.
Yes, sir.
All right.
How did you get him involved? Why was he involved, rather than my speculation about it?
Well, there were a couple of small roles in the movie that were created almost by me and by Vikram and by Dana O'Keefe, the creative producer who was a part of all these conversations as well. They were kind of created as places we could plug in interesting cameos that had certain kinds of significance, you know, for us and for viewers. And the book vendor was one of them. And I actually beefed up his role in order to make it a juicier cameo for whoever we plugged in. And, you know, there were just certain people who resonated, who felt right in that role. So, I mean, there were a couple people that we sort of like approached and tried to cast, and Fab ended up being the guy who worked out. It's funny, we were filming in Fab's neighborhood one day, and he kind of like, we had reached out to him, I think via J Period, shout out to Jay. Fab was like, oh, yo, I saw the signs, like they're filming around my block. So he just showed up on the set one day and kind of peeped us and what we were doing. And that's when we locked down that he was going to do it. Before that, we had reached out to Chuck D, who was too humble to do it, typically, in typical fashion. We had talked about Black Thought doing it. He was down, but he was like unavailable. I tried to get Kamau to do it. Kamau was like, you don't understand. I'm a terrible actor. but, you know, Fab just, it just made a certain kind of sense, you know. It just felt right, you know, to plug him into that.
Yeah, and I felt a sort of like subtle kind of nod to Wild Style a little bit also, because it's just sort of the same era and he played such a big role in that.
Oh, man.
Yo, what's up, Faye? These your friends?
This is Virginia. She's a reporter, man. They all right. They cool, man. This is my man Ray here. Ain't no need for this.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and in real life, Fab was a connector. He was a guy who bridged worlds. And that is exactly what Barry is in the process of becoming. So, I mean, on, you know, in the history of New York hip hop, Fab is one of these guys who brought uptown downtown. He brought Flash and Bam and all these guys to the downtown clubs, to the Mud Club, to Danceteria, to these places, introduced the rap cats to the new wave punk, etc. You know, brought black and white together, brought uptown and downtown together, bridged worlds. And so in that sense, he's talking to a guy who is going to kind of do the same on a global level, right? Obama's going to go on to be a guy like that in part. I mean, he's also, you know, thanks to the racism of this country, a incredibly polarizing figure as well. But because Fab played that role as a kind of connector of worlds, it felt appropriate for him to be handing off literature to young Barry also.
Yeah. Now, I know you've done stuff with the Obama campaign in the past. You did the, like, you have to fucking vote PSA thing.
It's called Wake the Fuck Up, but yeah.
Wake the Fuck Up, yeah, sorry. Have you met Obama?
No, I haven't. The closest I came thus far, the closest I've come, was finding out that he really liked Wake the Fuck Up, which starred Sam Jackson and was a 2012 campaign spot that we did, not coordinated with the campaign, but on Obama's behalf, essentially targeting sort of disaffected Obama voters who like were maybe less inclined 4 years later to get out and not just vote, but organize and participate again. And it's like this 9-year-old white girl wandering through her house, talking to all her relatives, trying to convince them, you know, to get active. And when they dismiss her, Sam Jackson shows up and curses them out and tells them to wake the fuck up.
Mom, Dad, the election's coming up soon.
We're tired right now, hon. Go back to your room.
Sorry, my friend, but there's no time to snore. An out-of-touch millionaire's just declared war. On schools, the environment, unions, fair pay. We're all on our own if Romney has his way. And he's against safety nets. If you fall, tough luck. So I strongly suggest that you wake the fuck up.
So we heard that Obama really liked it and was even doing parts of it backstage in a Sam Jackson voice at some event. So, you know, that's the closest I've come to meeting him so far, you know. But hey, he's about to be a private citizen. You know, he can just like holler at me in February and, you know, invite me over for, you know, dinner or something if he's so inclined.
Right. And
I don't know if he's a regular listener to the Cypher, but, you know,
we like to think that he is.
I'm open to that. I'm open to that, Mr. President.
So I know, obviously, because I've talked to both of you about it, but the graffiti in the film kind of has its own backstory with former Cypher guest Blake Lethem. Can you talk about that a little bit, how you got him involved and kind of the sorts of things he was thinking about?
Absolutely. You know, Blake, a.k.a. Keo, a.k.a. Lord Scotch, a.k.a. Scotch 79, a.k.a. like four or five other alii that I'm still finding out about. Blake is a brilliant dude and an incredible artist and an incredible historian of graffiti. And he's done a couple book covers of mine. He's a good friend and a collaborator of mine and somebody I kind of look forward to working with more in the future on different projects. You know, graffiti obviously lends so much to the character of New York in 1981. I brought him in and introduced him to Vikram and the team and got him involved as kind of the graffiti art director, not just because he's a dope painter, but because he brings such exacting detail and precision and historical knowledge to the project. So like, you know, if we were filming a scene that took place on the Far East Side in 1981, you know, Blake would say to himself, like, okay, when Barry walks past this vacant graffiti covered lot, what would we see there? Who would be, what writers would be active at that time? How long would tags and pieces and throw ups be running in this lot without getting buffed? So how far back does that history go? You know, what gangs might have a kind of faded aerosol presence on the Upper East Side at that time? All of this thought went into it, you know, and that was just really emblematic of the kind of attention to detail that we all really wanted to bring to this project. So like really every single piece of graffiti in the movie, from the simplest tag on a, you know, above a door buzzer, to the more elaborate pieces that he did on walls and inside of Danceteria, there's a story behind each of them and there's a rationale to each of them. And you know, it's incredible that he was able to be part of it and bring that level of accuracy to it.
Yeah. And there are scenes inside Danceteria.
Yes.
Obviously, they go there, I think, twice over the course of the movie. In the first time they go there, you see B-boys.
Now we're back for more. Hot to give the party people what we have in store. So let's play the game.
Have you ever seen this? This is the
no.
It's a New York thing.
What was involved with that? Who were the dancers? Was the dancing era appropriate? What was the story there?
Yeah, absolutely. This is another thing I was able to be involved in. And, you know, I should say I'm really lucky and fortunate as a writer on this project to have been a part of things like bringing Blake in and helping to find the dancers for Danceteria, because, you know, a lot of writers in the film world are treated like second-class citizens. They're literally maybe barred from the set. You know, I was on the set for like 3 weeks of the filming and I was consulted on things and I was able to, you know, hang out with the actors and talk to them about the roles. And that's the benefit of doing this stuff with friends and collaborating on a deep level that transcends just, you know, what's on paper contractually. So it was certainly very important for us to get dancers who would know how to authentically dance like it was 81. So Vikram asked me to help him find the guys, and I went through another friend of the Cypher, another friend of mine, Dr. Joseph Schloss, who wrote, in my mind, two of the most seminal books on hip-hop, Foundation, which is about the history of b-boying in New York City, and Making Beats, which, you know, is about Italian cooking. No, it's about making beats. You know, so I was, you know, so we reached out to Joe, because Joe is very connected to the scene. And Joe was able to point us toward people who he felt would, you know how to do that shit. Because, you know, dancing in 81, b-boying in 81 looks different than b-boying in 2016, right? You don't want somebody doing crazy bananas acrobatic air moves and, you know, triple Lundies and shit. You want somebody who's schooled in foundation and doing the kind of shit that you would see in the club in 81. So through Joe and the people that Joe connected us to and the people that they connected us to, we were able to get guys who, like, you know, kind of had an unbroken lineage in New York City and had studied with guys who were active in 81 and who were young enough to look the way B-boys in a club in 81 would look, which is, you know, like 18-year-olds, but also like knew how to rock appropriately.
And the songs you used, the hip hop song specifically, there's a couple of them sort of sprinkled through the movie. Were those in the script? Did you write those particular songs in?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, there were a bunch of different iterations of the script in terms of how much music was included in it. Because there's like the script that is really written for the director, and that includes my dream soundtrack, you know, every song that I hope can be in the movie.
Clearance issues aside or whatever.
Exactly, right. And then there's like the version of the script that you show to the producers that doesn't have $2 million worth of music in it that's going to terrify them. You know what I mean?
Right.
So like there were, I mean, you know, obviously music is important, and particularly in a period piece and for me to evoke New York and to evoke these different scenes. So there were versions of the script where there was a ton of music written in, and then it kind of all got taken out and was replaced with the music that we could get, which in some cases was the exact same music. But that was another thing that I was able to be part of the conversation on and talking to the music supervisors on and stuff. And they did an incredible job. So like the early scene when Barry gets on the subway, having come straight from JFK, and these B-boys get on the train, and there's like a boombox inches from his face.
Trying to get Jekyll and Hyde, but if you keep us happy, girl, we'll keep you.
You know, originally, I think I had, I know it was a Treacherous 3 song. I want to say it was New Rap Language was the one that I said they would be bumping. Given that it's like August 1981, that would have been the jam. I think that ended up being replaced with a different Treacherous 3 song, probably because it was a little less expensive or something. You know, I know that originally when they walk into Danceteria, they walk in just as the DJ is dropping Once in a Lifetime by the Talking Heads, and then he goes into Heartbeat. And, you know, I had this whole, and then he goes into like Jazzy Sensation.
And you may tell yourself, this is not my beautiful house. And you may tell yourself, this is not my beautiful wife.
I had all these things lined up, you know, the Harlem party, I like, you know, they play Rick James, and then when he's dancing, the DJ train wrecks into Rapper's Delight. And there was even a line in the script where Barry's like, I never need to hear this song again, you know, and the girl's like, no shit, you know, because it's 2 years old at this time.
Right.
So it's a process of negotiation, but like, I'm really, really happy with how it all turned out, how the soundtrack goes. Vikram made some really dope decisions. I remember sending him like 15 different songs for the final credits to choose from. And he ended up choosing one that was none of them, but that does everything that they do.
From a lot of places, but I live here now.
You know, it's funny with music. It's a question of capturing a certain vibe, right? It's like, so, okay, you want a sense of uplift. You want a sense of soulfulness. You want like these eight qualities. You know, it's like building your own Pandora station or some shit. I'm like, okay, here's like 10 songs that in my mind do those things that I've thought of / crowdsourced. You know, I remember reaching out to like different record heads and music heads to be, you know, to, you know, it's like you ask these like kind of like ethereal, weird questions. You're like, I remember reaching out to Oliver Wang, who I think is also yet another friend of the Cypher, right? You've had Oliver on.
Yeah.
And being like, Oliver, I want a song like For Goodness Sakes, Give More Power to the People by the Shy Lights. But not that song. What else is like that? You know, and it's like, to answer that question, you have to assimilate what are the essential, you know, qualities of that song.
Yeah.
And if you're, you know, if you're a computerized radio station, you might decide that it's like four-part harmony. But that's the least important part of that song in terms of what it conveys. You know what I mean? It's a weird, it's a weird thing. Anyway.
There's a ton of stuff in the movie, you know, that I wanted to get into. But I think one of the most interesting things for me is the character who becomes his roommate, who he first runs into in New York, of Salim.
Yeah.
How did the character of Salim come about? Is there any sort of real life analog for him? I guess let's start there.
Yeah, there is. One of the most inspiring things that Vikram sent me in the early stages as we developed the story in order to kind of spur my thinking was this clip of this guy who was Barry's roommate, who in the book is discussed very briefly, and he has a different name. You know, it's like there's his real name, there's his name in the book, then there's his name in the movie, which is, as you said, Salim. And he was this Pakistani guy who Barry had met at a party in L.A. at Occidental. He had a number of Pakistani friends, and he arrived, this part is true, he arrives in New York really with just the one phone number. So when he's locked out of his apartment, which again really happened, this is like the only guy he has to call. So the video that Vikram sent me is, you know, like they tracked this guy down when Obama was running for president in 2007. And he's kind of this like disheveled, wild haired, middle aged guy now who's like sitting on an ugly couch in Seattle. And they're like, so tell us about your old friend, Barack Obama. And the dude is like, man, I remember when he was cool, you know. he's so disappointed. He's like, when I met Barry, he was cool. And we used to like hang out and like drink and like go to parties. And then he just became a fucking bore.
Initially, I liked him more, you know, the fun-loving young guy, easygoing. I met an Occidental and he was like that for the first year, maybe a year and a half in New York. But certainly by the later stages of our cohabiting, you know, he'd gotten increasingly dull in my opinion.
Dull in what way?
Was too serious, wouldn't want to go around the bar, have a drink, was worried about poor people, didn't care about getting rich, you know, that to me, I mean, that's my opinion of dull at that time.
What do you think?
Homie, your man is a senator running for president right now. And like, he just evinces all this disappointment. He's just so disappointed in like the direction Obama's life took. And it comes across so viscerally. And he's just like, it was hilarious. And like, that really spurred the development of the character. You know, but that was a character we all cared a lot about, you know, in some ways, the scenes between Barry and Salim are my favorites in the movie. They were my favorite to write. I wrote a bunch of other ones, you know, which didn't make it in because it was just, at a certain point, we're also in love with Salim, that it was like, okay, we need to like tailor this a little bit because Salim is on screen more than Charlotte, you know? And that's like, that's not the balance we're going for. And I should say, Avi Nash, who plays Salim, is a great dude and a fucking hilarious dude and a great actor and was like one of my favorite people to hang out with on the set. And just like killed it and stayed in character, stayed with the accent the entire shoot, even when he was not on set. You know, to this day, I don't actually know what Avi actually sounds like. like, you know, the character was important because he represented sort of another other, you know, another outsider, another brown person who was caught between worlds and who is navigating this New York of 1981 in a certain kind of way. And he's also, just as importantly, the only guy in the movie or the main guy in the movie who is willing, able, and enthusiastic about talking shit to Barry. You know, he brings Barry down. He makes fun of him. They have a camaraderie.
They will never accept us, Barry. I know you know this, my brother.
I don't know. I want to think they will.
You think too much. It's your problem. That's why you never get laid.
Well, I'm not trying to just get laid.
Okay, see what I mean? Fucking shit, man. Look, if I were you...
Hello there, rich white girl. My name is Barry. I just transferred here from Africa. I'm a deep, brooding man who likes to write poems about the mysteries of the human condition. Now, would you like to unzip my pants, or shall I?
Yeah, that's pretty good. I didn't know you could do me.
Oh, well, the trick is to sound just white enough.
Okay. Fuck you, Salim.
Betty, Betty, I love you.
Salim is kind of a mess. His own life seems to be spiraling a bit out of control, but he's relentless in his ability to cut Barry down to size, bring him down to earth, make fun of him. And that was really important, you know? And that camaraderie and that relationship is a very important one in the movie. And we joked a lot on the set about the Salim sequel, the spinoff, like the further adventures right. of Salim, you know, which I'm very enthusiastic about making.
I look forward to it. Someone else who cuts Barry down to size a little bit is his mother, who kind of comes in for this sort of extended sequence somewhere in the middle.
Yeah.
How did you write Anne Dunham? I mean, she's obviously not around anymore, you know, to have reached out to or spoken to. How'd you write her? How'd you figure that out?
You know, largely based on the book. I mean, again, you know, the time period we're talking about is very opaque. Obama really only spends about 6 pages in Dreams from My Father on these years at Columbia, which again attracted me to the project because it was this sparse framework that I could improvise on. But he does get into some discussion of his mother there. And, you know, there are other sources, obviously, as well. The one incident in the movie involving his mother that is real, I mean, in the sense of really happened, is the two of them watching Black Orpheus, which was a point of tension and disruption or rupture, I guess, in their relationship. This was a movie that Anne Dunham had seen at 16 as a girl in Kansas. It was the first foreign movie she ever saw, and she fell in love with it. And she and Barry go see it, and she's just as enraptured with it as she always has been, and it really pisses him off. Because in his estimation, this is a very condescending, simplistic portrayal of the Black folk in the movie as kind of these happy, smiling, unsophisticated savages. And he's offended not just by the portrayal, but by what it seems to say about how Anne might have viewed his father when she met him a few years later.
Is something wrong?
I'm just thinking about the movie.
About you and the movie.
What was it you loved so much? When you first saw it, I mean.
It was beautiful. It was so exotic. I'd never seen anything like it.
Like that?
That comes across very clearly in the scene of them walking together after the movie.
Yes, yes. So, I mean, you know, we had that to kind of spin off of. Yeah, I mean, she in some ways, she's a focal point. She allows us to do a lot of things. There's some dramatizing of Barry's relationship with his girlfriend, Charlotte, that we can do via his feelings about his mother. There's a lot that comes out about his relationship with his father through his mother. You know, we knew that she was not going to appear in much of the movie. We knew that it was also a place to plug in, you know, like a powerhouse actress. And we did that in the form of Ashley Judd, who I think is fantastic in the movie. It was this time to kind of potentially pack a lot into like a 15-minute sequence. So we learn a lot through her about Barry's childhood, about his relationship with his father, about her relationship with his father, about his relationship to being raised by white people. You know, there's just a lot in there. And we wanted to kind of make the most of it and give her some dimension too. You know, she's formidable, but she's also a little goofy. She's a little corny to him. She's got this kind of hippie vibe that is kind of makes him wince a little bit.
Now this takes me back. This land is my land from California, right on, brother.
So corny, Mom.
But he also is willing to confide in her. There's a closeness there. So we really wanted to do a lot in a short amount of time with her character.
Yeah, and I thought one of the things, this scene after she visits when Barry and Charlotte are kind of decompressing about it, and Charlotte, of course, is, oh, she's so great, she's amazing, and Barry seems like any 20-year-old kid would be running into his mother, you know, a little embarrassed and a little like, oh, you don't really know.
Yeah.
She's kind of mortifying.
Your mom is awesome.
Yeah, she's something, all right.
No, seriously. How many girls from Kansas end up working at the Ford Foundation in Indonesia?
Well, first you marry an Indonesian guy, then you move to Indonesia and realize you need a job.
Which I thought was, it was great to see, you know, this guy who would go on to become Barack Obama, just embarrassed about his mother, like any guy his age.
Your parent could be the coolest motherfucker in the world, and at that age, you're going to be mortified by them. And no amount of reassurance by anybody else is going to convince you that they're anything other than incredibly embarrassing.
Right. So the Charlotte character, obviously a, you know, you and Vikram and other interviews have said that it is a composite of a couple white women he dated during the time period in the movie and maybe slightly afterwards. How did sort of the parts of her personality kind of come together? How did she end up like she did?
Again, yeah, there was some compositing. There are interviews with a couple of women. There are letters he wrote back and forth with a couple of women he dated. So there's some compositing and amalgamating, and there's also just a lot of sheer invention. What kind of a woman would have both been compelling to him, would have pushed him in certain ways, would have opened a door into a certain world that he would have sort of hesitated and viewed from the threshold and had to make a decision about whether or not to enter and kind of ultimately decline to enter? What kind of politics would she have? Would her family have? So, you know, all of these things were kind of calibrated for effect. You know, there's no real life parallel per se for any of the women he dated coming from an active, democratic, sort of liberal, progressive family like hers. But that seemed like an interesting world for him to bump into and bump up against. Had we made them staunch Republicans, Reaganites, you know, that would have been interesting in a different way. So, you know, these were choices we were able to make just kind of based on what was going to be most fruitful. There were certain things that were on the record, like one of the women he dated. Well, all of the women he dated agreed that there was kind of a sensitivity to him, but also a detachment, a removal, that he could, you know, he could be very present, engaged, loving, passionate, but also that he could get in his own head and kind of be a million miles away, which, you know, is not surprising, right? We could see that. We could have assumed that without them saying so. There were a couple little jewels and gems that it was like, oh, shit, this is almost too on the nose. One of them made it into the movie, which is that one of these women did report that she told him she loved him, and he said, thank you.
Call me later.
Yeah, I will.
I love you.
Thank you.
Wow.
Yeah. Which made it into the movie, and which Barry and his friend PJ, played by Jason Mitchell, discuss afterward and discuss in reference to the similar response from Han Solo in Empire Strikes Back, which had just come out at that time. PJ is like, damn, you, or yeah, I forget what the lines are exactly, but there's some reference to you know, you Han Solo'd her.
Thank you. What are you, Han Solo or some shit, man?
Han didn't say thank you. He said, I know.
I love you.
I know.
That's the coolest way to say it, sure.
Fucked up, huh?
And
there was another line that you couldn't use because from real life, right?
Yeah, well, there was a line that was in the script. One of these women also at some point came to the decision that the woman Barry should be with was, in her words, like a strong black woman, right? And you know, there was a version of the limousine scene where Barry and Charlotte are on the way to her sister's wedding, and they get into a kind of discussion of marriage.
Well, would you ever want to get married?
I don't mean now.
I don't even mean to me. I just mean, is it something you could see yourself doing someday?
No, it's not an institution I put much faith in. I mean, my parents were married 5 times between them, or 6. And I'm not even sure about my father.
There's a longer version of that scene where she drops that on him. And he's like, what the fuck are you talking about? You know, it's a really bugged out thing to say. And he's like, are you breaking up with me? No? Well, what are you, is this a commentary? I mean, we had this whole thing. And ultimately, it wasn't necessary and it got cut. And that's probably for the best. But that was one of these things where it's like, holy shit, that's so on the nose. And yet it really happened. And, you know, that's one of the hardest things I think as a screenwriter is to, and it's funny because, you know, I used to teach fiction to like graduate students. This is exactly the kind of thing that would come up in a workshop, right? Somebody would write a story. Somebody in the class would say, this thing in your story, I find it unbelievable. I find it unrealistic. And a lot of times the person whose story it is responds by saying, it really happened. That really happened. And my role as the instructor in that room is to tell them that that is irrelevant, that whether or not it really happened does not matter and is not evidence for the defense. That if it reads as unbelievable on the page, then the shit is unbelievable. And no amount of like sourcing and footnoting and defending it by saying it happened is going to help your cause, which is a lesson that I should have remembered when I was writing this screenplay.
So there's this one scene, right, where Barry first sits down with Charlotte's parents at some fancy, intimidating dinner at the Yale Club. And he almost immediately slips into like future politician mode, charms them and finds out exactly, sort of susses out exactly what they want to hear.
You know, I have to admit, it's kind of strange for me to be at the Yale Club. I'm from a Harvard family.
Huh. Didn't know that.
That makes two of us.
Yes, sir. My father did his PhD in economics there, on a full scholarship, as a matter of fact.
Well, he must be brilliant.
Oh, he is something. I mean, Dad was born in Kenya, and he and my mother met when he was studying at the University of Hawaii. The program that brought him over was funded by the likes of Harry Belafonte and Sidney Poitier. And the Kennedys.
How remarkable. Mm. And where is he now?
Dad's back in Nairobi. I believe his title is Senior Government Economist.
But can't quite keep it together for more than a minute or two before he starts lapsing into whatever was on his head, in his head, like PJ's future or whatever.
Yeah.
And I thought that was so fascinating to catch like just a glimpse of him as future politician guy. And then it kind of goes away. Can you talk about writing that scene in particular?
Yeah, well, you know, there's a lot going on in that scene. And it was supposed to be, as you say, kind of a showcase for Barry's ability to really turn on the charm. And it's something that we don't see from him all the time. I mean, there's a lot of brooding and withdrawal from him in this movie. And it's not all the time that we see him turn on the megawatt smile and crank the charisma to 10. And this is one of those times that he does, but there's also some subtle, he begins to kind of rewrite his own story in front of Charlotte's disbelieving eyes, right? He's uncomfortable in this setting. There's a level of intimidation, and he's coming from the men's room where a dude has assumed that this young black man in a suit and tie is the fucking washroom attendant and tipped him with a fiver. And he gets to the table and realizes that is his girlfriend's father, who doesn't even seem to recognize him because who looks at the washroom attendant?
Right.
He's, you know, there's a level of anger that is simmering, a level of disbelief, a level of discomfort. He's in this very rarefied space, and he's both charming and disarming and politically astute in what he has to say, but also he begins to kind of not rewrite his biography, but shift it in ways that are going to be impressive and beneficial, specifically around his father, right? You know, he has a line, he says something like, I have to admit I'm very uncomfortable in the Yale Club. And it's like, that's met with kind of horror and disbelief and confusion and everything. You know, that statement is an articulation of what everybody else at the table is kind of afraid of. And
right, but he uses it as a setup.
Yeah, exactly. And he uses it as a setup. It's exactly that. You know, that's the articulation of what they fear, but are afraid to admit that they fear, because to fear that is a little bit racist and classist and presumptuous. But yes, then it's a setup, because he's like, because I'm from a Harvard family. And everybody visibly relaxes. And then he goes on to wax about, you know, his father who went to Harvard and, you know, and this is a guy he has no relationship with, right? But he talks about him with all of this pride, and Charlotte's looking at him like, what the fuck are you talking about? So for Charlotte, it's a bit of an unsettling moment. It's a little eerie almost, you know? She's watching her boyfriend put on this act in a way. And, you know, nothing he says is, it's not like he's lying. These are truths of a certain kind. But it's weird for her. It's unsettling for her. The parents ease into it. The comfort is there. He's charming the shit out of them. And, you know, and yeah, and then the conversation veers into politics. It veers into his friend PJ, who's, you know, this business student from the projects, and like, what does his future hold? Yeah, that was a scene that we were always viewing as a very important one in the movie, a kind of a linchpin scene that had to be calibrated just right. And again, it's one where there were different versions, like longer, shorter, lines that came in, lines that came out, lines that really like nailed it, you know. I mean, all of these things, it's funny to think back on just how many discussions, how long Vikram and I sat and discussed each and every one of these things to make sure that we were really doing everything that we needed to do in a given scene or in a given sequence.
Yeah. Towards the end of the movie, some of the last people that Barry meets are real life activists, the late Grace Lee Boggs and James Boggs.
Meet James and Grace Lee, two of the most brilliant, committed writers and activists I have ever had the pleasure to know.
I'm honored to meet you.
Grace Lee tried to convince Malcolm X to run for Senate in 64.
It almost worked, too.
Wow.
I thought you might want to meet them, especially because of your parents.
Have a seat, Barry.
Are your parents in the movement?
No, not really. They're different races. I'm guessing that's what Kathy meant.
Why include them?
That was another, you know, I mean, that's a flight of fancy. Like, that didn't happen. There, you know, he did not meet them. And in fact, this wedding never happened. So.
Right. I was going to say he didn't meet them at the wedding because the character's family, you know, the character whose family it is never.
Right. Grace Lee Boggs and James Boggs did not attend this wedding that did not exist.
Right. And I know that Obama was aware of Grace Lee Boggs. He put out statements for like her birthday and her passing and that kind of stuff. But I don't know if they ever actually met.
Yeah. No, there's no evidence to suggest that they did at this time. The idea of him meeting them, meeting this biracial couple, these activists, and having an interaction with them, you know, it was something that evolved over time and over a number of drafts, and that felt right in a certain kind of way that illuminated for him at that moment some of, you know, a number of possible futures, an alternate future to the one that he could imagine or was quickly becoming unable to imagine with Charlotte. You know, it's interesting, an earlier version of the story made a lot more use of Jesse Jackson, actually.
Mm, who's kind of a ghost in this one a little bit.
Yeah, he is. You hear him on the radio, Barry references him in class and gets kind of called out for it.
If the states had voted on slavery, we would have lost the vote. So, yeah, at that point, moral authority kicks in to defend the minority against the will of the people. And that's when the spears come out.
Yeah, I watched the news last night too, Barry. Jesse Jackson said that thing about slavery.
Yeah, he did. And he's right.
Seriously, the guy who hugged Yasser Arafat is right.
One thing has nothing to do with the other.
There was a version of this movie where Jesse featured prominently, where Barry heard him on the radio, where Barry went to see him preach at Abyssinian, and where he shows up at this wedding and Obama watches him from across the room. I never wrote a scene in which they actually interacted. There was never a version of the movie where, like, he meets him at the wedding, but there was a version where he's at the wedding and he's kind of holding court. And there's a moment where we think that Barry is going to approach him, but instead chooses not to. So, yeah, you know, it's funny. And those were really early, like, versions. Like, though that stuff fell out of the script relatively early. It's not like these are scenes that were, like, shot and not used. This is, like, just very early iterations of my thinking and Vikram's thinking about the story. But, you know, as Jesse diminished, I think I held on to the idea of Barry having an encounter of some kind with somebody who was engaged in the work of activism at this wedding. And actually, you know, part of the reason that Charlotte's family in the movie are who they are, that is to say that her father is a lawyer who is politically active and has, you know, defended activists and bailed them out of jail and been, you know, involved in union organizing and things like that. Part of that was to plausibly set up the presence of someone like a Jesse Jackson or a Grace Lee Boggs at this wedding, in fact. So it's funny, you know, you set up certain things to pay off in one way and instead they, you know, pay off in another way. So yeah, part of it is that.
Mm. There's a couple other sort of political ghosts floating around the movie other than Jesse Jackson. It's Reagan, Ronald Reagan, and Ed Koch.
Yeah, absolutely.
They're sort of like phantoms. You never see them. You hear their voice or you hear people talking about them, or in Koch's case, see them on television.
Right.
Why those figures? Is it just because they were kind of the biggest things happening at the time?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, you know, it's 1981. It's morning in America, as Reagan would have it, right? He's just been elected in a landslide pretty recently. You know, and he's emblematic of so much of the direction that the country's going to take, obviously, with him at the helm. And the fact that, you know, the president is an actor, as Obama says, as Barry says in the movie.
The biggest city in America, and this guy gets to run as a Democrat and a Republican? Fucking joke.
Well, nobody's watching except us.
So, why are we watching?
It's our civic duty.
Politics is bullshit.
You don't really believe that, do you?
Yeah, I mean, kind of. I mean, come on, the president's an actor.
So how does change happen then? Or do you not believe in change either?
I believe in art. I believe in, I don't know, people creating change.
You know, Ed Koch was a dominant figure in New York politics at that time, and is also it's a pretty bizarre situation because he's running for mayor for a second term, not unopposed, but as the nominee of both the Democratic and Republican parties.
Ed Koch won the 1981 New York City mayoral election in a landslide with almost 75% of the vote.
So he's running against a bunch of kind of like minor party standard bearers who have, you know, like no hope whatsoever. And it's striking to Barry that it's ridiculous that in the biggest city in America, this guy should be able to run as both a Democrat and a Republican. That seems like absurd to him. And he comments on it. These figures were in the mix because he would have had an awareness of them. He's not yet interested in politics, but you know, he's not so disinterested that he's not going to be aware of the kind of major figures and the poles of mainstream political thought, you know?
And in fact, you have him very pointedly describe himself as a poet at one point in the film.
Them.
A socialist?
A poet.
I am a poet, actually.
Yeah. At that time, he was really thinking seriously of himself as possibly a poet, possibly a writer. And again, like, these are directions we pursued and ended up cutting. There's a version of the script in which he goes to a downtown poetry cafe and performs at an open mic.
And, oh my god!
And the experience of it is so whack that it basically destroys his appetite to be a poet. He He basically goes.
Did you go so far as to write him a poem to perform at that scene?
No. What we did was take a poem that he published around that time and have him perform a piece of it.
Sitting in his seat, a seat, broad and broken, in, sprinkled with ashes, pop switches channels, takes another shot of Seagram's, neat, and asks, what to do with me? A green young man who fails to consider the phlegm and flam of the world since things have been easy for me. I stare at his face, a stare that deflects off his brow.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, he published a couple poems in literary journals, college literary journals at the time. So we had his material. I didn't like have to write his bars for him.
Okay.
But the gist of that scene was just him realizing how solipsistic and obnoxious that scene was. Basically that there are 30 people there and like 25 of them are just there to read their poem and nobody gives a fuck about hearing anybody else's shit. And he kind of looks out at this crowd and is like, Jesus Christ, like, if I'm here in 30 years, kill me. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
All these people are just kind of, yeah, it's that kind of thing. But, you know, it didn't serve. And there were also scenes where he discusses this idea of being a writer with his professor and gets some kind of tough talk about it. And again, these are things that ended up falling out of the movie, you know, not because they weren't good, but because, you know, we had to do some real, you know, we had to really do some tailoring and streamlining of what we wanted to get across. And again, Vikram was like really, really exacting in wanting everything to be there for a reason and to line up and for the flow of it and the messaging of it to all make sense. So things that strayed too far or represented paths that didn't resolve or didn't terminate in some kind of way, like, you know, just it ended up not being there.
Did anything change, like individual lines or even scenes or the order of things once filming started, like in the process of filming?
Yeah, absolutely. Not, you know, not in hugely like significant ways, but if you're lucky as a writer, you have actors who make your shit better, you know? and I was lucky in that respect. Guys like Avi Nash and Jason Mitchell took some of these lines and like improved the fuck out of them, you know? So like there are scenes like the scene where Salim is watching Barry prepare for his date with Charlotte. And I think actually the final version that's in the movie is pretty much as written. He's talking about, he's like, you know, talking all this shit. He's like, you know, how about you answer everything they say? Start every answer with shit, motherfucker. You know, he's like, so Barry, what are you doing this summer? Shit, motherfucker. I'm thinking about getting an internship at a law firm.
How about whatever they ask you, you start every answer with shit, motherfucker. So, Barry... New York must be quite the change from Hawaii. Shit, motherfucker. It sure is. Have you started to think about the summer yet, Barry? Shit, motherfucker. I'm considering taking an internship at a law firm.
These are they're all great ideas.
Yep.
I was on set that day and watched Avi riff and improvise and crack everybody the fuck up for like 2 straight hours in like a freezing cold, you know, airplane hangar looking set that we had constructed. You know, like, I mean, some of Jason Mitchell's stuff, you know, he took the gist of what I'd written and just like freaked it, you know. Shout out to him for that. You know, like, I think it's, you know, like when they're talking about taking Barry to the party, he's like, shit, you know, like, get this motherfucker, you know, take him to a luau or something.
You should come out with us tonight. What's on the agenda? Your girl Tisha's having a thing.
Tisha? Really? You don't need to be taking them boys to nobody ghetto-ass house party.
Why not?
Why not?
Great. This man from Indonesia and Hawaii and shit, man. You don't need that in his life, man. Take him to a luau or something. None the better.
How's a brother supposed to get culture?
You know, and like, I never wrote that, but it's like, it's a great line, you know, so I'll take the credit for it.
Yeah, why not? Why not?
You know, these things are like, you want these things to be fluid.
Right.
I mean, some directors do and some directors don't, you know, but I think if you're smart, you let people make your shit better.
Yeah.
There's also lines that were delivered exactly as written, but not with the intonation or the delivery that I imagined at all. you know, and you're like, oh shit, that's different. Sometimes you like it, sometimes you don't, you know. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, you know, and of course, this is why you do, you know, 29 fucking takes, so that you can be covered and you can like, okay, well, you know, do it this way, do it that way, freak it, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, I know that you've talked about how one of the things it's about is race, obviously, and him thinking about race and people reacting to his race, but it's also a movie about masculinity and kind of about gender.
Yeah. You know, I think these things obviously are very connected, right? I mean, we, you know, one of the buzzwords right now is intersectionality, and obviously conceptions of race and masculinity are very connected, both in terms of, you know, this country's fear and hatred of black bodies and black male bodies, and you know, particularly in the context of this film, we're dealing with an interracial relationship at a time when, you know, such a thing is still going to attract a lot of unwanted and unfriendly attention, even in a city like New York, for a number of reasons, you know, and from a number of different communities, you know, and there's a way in which, as Barry, like any young man of that age, you know, he is an astute observer of masculinities, you know, of different competing versions, contrasting versions of what it looks like to be a man. And, you know, there's a sense in which I would even say every single man in the movie that he lays eyes on, he is studying and appraising as a potential model, you know, for good or for bad, what they all represent, how they all embody masculinity. What is at stake in each of these masculinities? And you know, the primary relationship in his life in this movie, to some extent, is with Charlotte, with a woman. And you know, particularly at that age, any such relationship is in some ways less about the other person and more about figuring out what it means to you to be a man, to be who you are. You know, so yeah, I think masculinity is at the forefront, in a way, with this movie. You know, it's not, it's possibly in more subtle ways, but it's certainly part of the equation, in a major way.
So there was something that I found out about you that I didn't know, actually, in kind of digging up, you know, recent interviews you'd done and stuff like that, and that is something about your family, about your maternal grandparents. Mm-hmm. Your maternal grandmother, I didn't know this, was a poet and sort of wrote often like parody poems and things like that. Looking back on it now, do you kind of see a connection between her work and Go the Fuck to Sleep that maybe you didn't even realize at the time?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think she would have dug Go the Fuck to Sleep. My grandmother was a poet and a very political poet. I mean, my grandmother, Felicia Kaplan, had a syndicated poetry column that ran in a number of newspapers called The Muse of the Week in Review. Like, first, let's just pause and think about the phrase syndicated poetry column.
Right.
You want to talk about some shit that does not exist? Syndicated poetry column, okay? It ran in the Boston Globe, which was like her hometown newspaper. She lived in Cambridge, and a number of other papers as well. And essentially what she did in this column was take current events and provide commentary on them, often very pointed, funny, cutting, incisive political commentary. So like whatever was in the news, she was taking on. You know, like she wrote a poem, for example, that I remember sort of reading and kind of learning about history through, because it was before my time. And she often took classical forms or famous poems and riffed on them and satirized and parodied. So like she had a joint called The Love Song of R. Milhouse Nixon, about Nixon's impeachment, but based on the T.S. Eliot poem, Love Song of Proof Rock, you know, and he's got lines, you know, the famous Proof Rock joint is like, it's about like fragility and aging and mortality. And it's like, you know, this guy, you know, he says shit like, do I dare to eat a peach? You know, and she's like, flips it and is like, do I dare them to impeach and shit like that. So basically, I mean, basically my grandmother was a really dope poet and a really dope person, but her wordplay, her rhyme game was tremendous.
Taken from her 1967 book, Cultural Slag, the following poem, Majority Problem, was likely published the previous year in a magazine such as Harper's or the Saturday Evening Post. Incidentally, Adam also told us that all of her books were illustrated by Edward Gorey.
Majority Problem. Women voters now outnumber men in national elections. Since the cradle-rocking sex is now equipped to swing elections, every politician's nexus must depend on these reflections. Now that woman has this power, will she want to swing it gaily with an atavistic glower like her personal shillelagh? Does her intellect allow her to absorb a rationale, or does logic tend to sour her and make her skitter faily? Does she reason like a cow or with the wisdom of Disraeli? Will the candidates who dream of winning women show acumen that extends to the extreme of postulating that she's human?
She embodied in her work all of the qualities really that make a great rapper. Possibly not breath control. That was not really on the agenda. She also smoked like a pack of cool cigarettes every day. So, you know, maybe not the breath control, but like, as I was growing up, as a hip hop kid, as an MC myself, her work was like this very close parallel. She was, in essence, doing the same shit that, you know, KRS-One or Chuck D was doing, which was like using wordplay and you know, wit and rhyme form to speak truth to power and comment and, you know, take down or attack or comment on, you know, the issues of the day. And, I knew that at the time, you know, like I was listening to these records and I was reading her work and I was hanging out with her while she did her work. And she made being a writer something that was very tangible and seemed possible to me, which is certainly a luxury a lot of people don't have. You know, like most people's dreams of being a writer are thwarted by their family. Mine was like supported by it because there was evidence, you know, in the house that you could do that. And she got into hip hop through me, you know, like as a woman in her 80s. Like I remember her calling me to tell me she was watching Yo MTV Raps. And we had a whole discussion about the K Solo song, Your Mom's in My Business, which was like what was on at the time that she turned it on. If you really like me, you let your mommy know she got her mind on business. Your mom's is in our business. She's in our business. Can't you see, girl? Your mom's trying to end this. Your mom. She bought me Criminal Minded, which was one of the first, still my favorite rap album of all time. I think I had done some work for her around the house, and she had offered to pay me by like buying me whatever cassette I wanted. So, you know, I did whatever I did. I was like 11, you know, and then we went to the store and she bought me Criminal Minded. So there it is. Very influential on my work. She and my grandfather, who was a judge, a law professor, and then a judge.
Right. And what I didn't realize, if Wikipedia is right, is that he had a lot to do with the Nuremberg trials. Is that true?
Well, if you ask him, it's not. But yeah, I mean, my grandfather was the youngest American legal counsel at the Nuremberg trials. So if you ask, I mean, like literally, I tried to ask him this a number of times. He passed away a few years ago at the age of 99. But I'd be like, Grandpa, like, yo, like Nuremberg, like, tell me about the shit. And he'd be like, you know, I got there at the end. Like, I didn't really do anything. Like in his version, literally, it's like he got there and sat down just as they were like putting the case files in the boxes and shit. And like, you know, like took you long enough, Kaplan, like, you know, like, but in reality, he was there for like 8 months or something. And it made a huge impression on him. The civility, the lawfulness of it, the fact that even in the aftermath of this tremendous tragedy, and, you know, my family is Jewish. My grandfather, this was very real and visceral, presumably for him. And he was very impressed just with the civility of the proceedings, the fact that in the aftermath of the Holocaust, the rule of law was being brought to bear on the perpetrators of these crimes, I think made a large impression on him, and also made him uninterested in going back into private practice in New York when it was all over. You know, I think after Nuremberg, the idea of working at a law firm didn't appeal to him anymore, even though the law firm he'd been at was this very progressive Jewish law firm that like defended James Joyce in his obscenity trial and so forth. I think after that, he saw a different type of future for himself that maybe was more about education and more about, you know, He was not an ambitious guy in the modern sense of ambition, like plotting and scheming to get ahead. He was just a brilliant fucking guy who whose brilliance was recognized and who, you know, I don't know, things were different back then. Like, you didn't apply for a job at Harvard Law School. You got a call from the dean of Harvard Law School who had been given your name by someone he trusted. And, you know, they were like, that's like how my grandfather started working there, is like, you know, a guy, the guy who was his like superior officer at Nuremberg, because these lawyers were technically in the army, right? You went from the Pentagon to Nuremberg. The guy who had been, you know, his boss is the guy who like recommended him to Harvard, you know? So it wasn't like, oh, let me put in my application and like, you know, commandeer my resources and like make sure all my mentors like put in a word for me. He was just kind of like minding his business and the phone rang, you know, very different times.
Do you ever think about what he might have to say about today's kind of political climate? And you have, you know, you have Trump and you have kind of this hard right kind of neo-fascist thing growing in so many European countries.
Yeah, no, I think I he would have been mortified. He only died in 2010. So he, you know, he was with us through the first couple of years of Obama's presidency. He was a big fan of Obama's. I mean, he was hard left. Like, my grandfather went on to be one of the judges on the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court, the Supreme Court of Massachusetts, and I think is considered to be the most progressive judge and possibly in the history of that institution. And yeah, I think about what he would have made of this. I think of what my grandmother would have made of this all the time. I mean, they're just intellectual touchstones for me always. So really kind of like anything I do, anything I write, I'm sort of thinking about what they might think of it. And I've, in my fiction, I've made attempts to kind of, write about them in a skewed, you know, fictionalized kind of way. My book, The End of the Jews, is largely a very kind of personal family one that kind of is, I don't know, a reimagining, of some of the issues inherent to their times, their marriage, their family, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
And on a lighter note, I guess, what could be heavier than that? You've done a couple books at this point with Alan Zweibel, who, you know, was a key early person in Saturday Night Live and It's Gary Shandling's Show and, you know, a zillion other kind of showbiz things of that era. What was it like kind of getting to work with him and seeing this whole kind of like old comedy, you know, 70s comedy guys, and even sort of older, you know, the world of, including literally the world of the Friars Club, which I know took you to. What was it like kind of seeing that world through him?
It's pretty great, I gotta say. I mean, so I've done three books now with Zweibel. Well, two books with Zweibel, which are these kids books we co-wrote that are basically a kid trading letters through time with Benjamin Franklin. And I write the kid's letters, he writes Franklin's letters. And then Alan and I and Dave Barry just wrote a book together, which is called For This We Left Egypt. And it's a parody of a Passover Haggadah, the liturgy that you read at the Passover ceremony, which is kind of, you know, like in book form. We just wrote this parody of it, which will be out in time for your 2017 Seder, should you choose to have one. It's great. I mean, like you say, I mean, Zweibel was one of the original Saturday Night Live writers. So, you know, he was like in the Catskills doing comedy with his buddy Billy Crystal in like the late 60s and early 70s, where Lorne Michaels found him, you know. And so he's not just a guy who's, you know, been a professional comedy writer since the 70s. He's also a guy whose heroes and icons go back, you know, 15 years before that. So this is, you know, like when he talks about comedy, you know, he talks about Henny Youngman, you know, he talks about Milton Berle and like Jack Parr and all these guys, you know, that I don't remember, and the Show of Shows and shit, you know, like it goes back to that. And it's fascinating to listen to, and the stories he has are incredible. It's, you know, like working with him and working with Dave is really bugged out for me, because these guys were seminal influences for me. It's like I'm working with guys who I idolized. I mean, I loved SNL as a kid, but really Dave Barry, like I read his columns religiously, and thought he was like the funniest dude ever. And like You know, if you went back and read the high school humor column that I wrote for my high school newspaper, it would basically be all Dave Barry ripoffs. Like everything I wrote at that time in an attempt to be funny were like half-assed Dave Barry jokes. So the fact that I'm actually doing books with these guys is phenomenal. And I learn a lot about comedy and about the approach, every day from them. And it's pretty phenomenal. Alan has this one story that he likes to tell about Henny Youngman that to me, I think for Alan, it epitomizes something about comedy. The story is very simple. Alan is leaving the Friars Club. Henny Youngman is, you know, a dozen paces ahead of him leaving the Friars Club. He doesn't know that Zweibel's behind him. He thinks he's alone. He's just walking out onto the street. A pigeon lands in front of Henny Youngman. And Henny Youngman, who again, and when Alan tells the story, he hammers home this point. He's like, he thinks he's alone, you know? So Henny Youngman bends down and says to the pigeon, any mail for me? Right? And like, you know, like, which is fucking hilarious on its own merits, right? But like, beyond that, I think what that means to Zweibel is that this is what it means to be a comedian. This is what it means to engage with humor is you tell the jokes. It doesn't matter if you're just speaking to a bird. You tell the joke because if you don't tell the joke, all the jokes behind it are going to get jammed up in the pipe. You know, like you got to tell the joke in order to be respectful of the joke's existence so that more jokes will follow. You just say it because it's funny. You don't say it to get a response because birds typically are unresponsive to most one-liners. I love that story. Like, I think, like, you know, it's also funny because at this point, Alan and I have done enough gigs together. We've been on stage together enough that I know all of his material, and I'm considering doing a one-man show where I just play Alan Zweibel.
Nice. And finally, I know that your editor for years has been, you know, now world famous superstar book editor, and as much as a book editor can be a superstar, Chris Jackson.
Yeah.
Chris Jackson is publisher and editor of the soon-to-be-relaunched One World imprint of Random House. The Harlem native has worked on bestsellers including Ta-Nehisi Coates' Between the World and Me, Eddie Wong's Fresh Off the Boat, and Jay-Z's 2010 hit, Decoded. He's also edited two of Adam's books, Angry Black White Boy and End of the Jews.
So, with that in mind, once and for all, who really wrote Decoded?
Yeah, you can't be asking me that shit, Sean. I'm going to get into too much trouble.
Okay, fair enough.
But Chris is a genius, and I hope to work with him again soon.
Definitely. As Adam says in our interview, Barry is a film that works even if the Barry of the film's title didn't turn out to be the president. It perfectly captures the New York of the early 80s, a time period we've delved into pretty extensively on our show over the years. It was great to see that era on film, with, as you've heard, so much thought put into every detail. But the movie is so much more than just the story of a young man getting to know New York City. It's about possibility, about a time in Obama's life when he began to realize who he was and who he had the potential to become. I encourage everyone to watch it if you haven't already. We'll be taking next week off for the holidays, but join us in 2 weeks on January 9th, when our guest will be super producer Salaam Remy. If you've heard a Nas, Fugees, or Amy Winehouse song you've liked in the past 20 years or so, he was probably behind it. We'll talk about his whole discography, from his early days with Curtis Blow, through his work with Nas and Amy, all the way to his brand new Do It for the Culture initiative. To make sure you hear each episode of The Cypher as soon as it drops, subscribe on iTunes or your podcast app of choice. Once you do that, you'll also be able to check out our back catalog. If you enjoy this show, for example, you can listen to our previous interview with Adam on episode 85. If you use iTunes, it's hugely important to give us a rating and a review. It helps bring more fans and attention to the show. Also consider helping us out by becoming a patron. Visit us at patreon.com/thecyphershow and sign up. Bringing you a show every single week takes a lot of time and effort from me and Josh, and we really need your support to continue to maintain this level of output. If even a quarter of our listeners contributed just $1 a month, you would go a long way towards making the show sustainable. As an added bonus for our patrons, we try monthly to share some bonus material that sometimes comes out when talking to our guests after the main interview is over. For January, we're bringing you some great stuff. Become a patron by December 31st to get access to the file. If you want to talk to me or Josh about the show, visit us on social media. We're at The Cypher Show on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Let us know what you thought of this episode and who you'd like to see on the show in the future. More information about anything related to the podcast, playlists, our complete archives, and more can be found for free at thecyphershow.com. The Cypher is created and written by Sean Sotero.
He reads Invisible Man, and that's something he talks about.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
He just got back from Italy, where he went because it's white truffle season.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
It's called Wake the Fuck Up.
Our web guru is Aaron Young.
Whether or not it really happened does not matter and is not evidence for the defense.
Special thanks to Patreon supporter Sean Franklin.
I probably shouldn't have talked all that shit.
Special thanks to Don Will for his rendition of Obama's poem Pop, the rest of which you can hear if you hang on to the end of this episode.
Somebody I kind of look forward to working with more in the future on different projects.
And extra special thanks to my favorite Jewish grandma, my mom, Jill Cross, for reading the Felicia Kaplan poem.
She's got this kind of hippie vibe.
We'll see you next time around on The Cypher.
Sitting in his seat, a seat, broad and broken, in, sprinkled with ashes, Pop switches channels, takes another shot of Seagram's, neat, and asks, what to do with me? A green young man who fails to consider the phlegm and flam of the world, since things have been easy for me. I stare at his face, a stare that deflects off his brow. I'm sure he's unaware of his dark, watery eyes that glance in different directions, and his slow, unwelcome twitches fail to pass. I listen, nod, listen, open, till I cling to his pale beige t-shirt yelling in his ears, that hang heavy with lobes, but he's still telling his joke. So I ask why he's so unhappy, to which he replies, but I don't care anymore. 'Cause he took too damn long. And from under my seat, I pull out the mirror I've been saving. I'm laughing loud, the blood rushing from his face to mine as he grows small, a spot in my brain, something that may be squeezed out like a watermelon seed between two fingers. Pop takes another shot, neat, points out the same amber stain on his shorts that I've got on mine and makes me smell his smell, coming from me. He switches channels, recites an old poem he wrote before his mother died, stands, shouts, and asks for a hug. As I shrink, my arms barely reaching around his thick, oily neck and his broad back, 'cause I see my face, framed within Pop's black framed glasses. And I know he's laughing too.
I feel like even I can probably do that.
I have had very stoned rappers pull this off.
Yeah. Cool.